My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. I created Destination Unlimited to examine the crossroads of science and spirituality. One of the most fascinating aspects of this is foundational religious history and how we've arrived at the tenets that are followed and accepted by mainstream religions today. As a young boy in the 1950s and 60s, I grew up with a culturally Jewish background and by rote attended Hebrew school in preparation for bar mitzvah. Having both an inquisitive mind and a spiritual bent, I wondered why women were relegated to a secondary and often demeaned role in the Torah, considering most of the wisdom that was offered to me came from school teachers who were women, and of course, my mother. Why were women not afforded the same regard, status, and dignity as their male counterparts, not only in religious tradition, but in the society that I was growing up in? Furthermore, if creation of life required both man and woman, how could a masculine God have created all of us without partnering with a goddess? Needless to say, I was chastised for asking these questions and really never got those answers until I began my interfaith studies and practice in the 1990s. What happened to the feminine divine and the ephemeral goddess? Was there evidence for God the Mother? My guests this week on Destination Unlimited, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, have been diligently researching and writing about this question and many more historical and religious mysteries since partnering in 1989. They are best-selling authors of The Stargate Conspiracy and The Templar Revelation, which directly inspired Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. They're frequent speakers at conferences around the world and regularly appear on TV series such as Forbidden History, History's Ultimate Spies, Medieval Murder Mysteries, and Ancient Aliens. They reside in the United Kingdom, and their website is picknettprince.com. They join me this week to discuss their just-published and latest book, When God Had a Wife, The Fall and Rise of the Sacred Feminine in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. It is my honor to welcome to Destination Unlimited, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. Welcome, you two.
Oh, thanks very much, Victor, for having us on. It's great.
And thank you for joining me. I've got to admit that it's really a thrill for me to welcome you both. I'm a bit of an overaged fanboy and really excited and grateful that you accepted my invitation. So again, thank you so much.
Mm. Well, no, it's a pleasure, absolute pleasure.
Now, when I welcome my guests for the first time, my audience enjoys hearing about their early paths and what led them to the work they do. So starting with Lynn, please share a bit about yourself and how you brought to this work.
Well, I began life in the 50s in the back streets of York, not New York, Old York in the north of England. And it was a very strange childhood because I was a very strange child. It was a haunted house and I was a visionary kid and I was desperate to be a religious fanatic. But seeing as the only possible outlet for that was the Church of England, it was actually almost impossible to be a Church of England fanatic. So, you know, so later on, I looked at other religions and, you know, basically just ignored them after a while because I realized that organized religions weren't for me and because they didn't have the thing, the X factor that I was looking for. And then I got into specialist journalism, if you like, writing about paranormal type things. I did a radio slot in the UK about people's paranormal experiences. But all the time, I was looking for, I suppose, the facts behind the weird phenomena that I'd encountered. And so that led me directly to encountering Clive.
And Clive, your story?
I mean, my interest really started with, like then, with the paranormal rather than a kind of religious or kind of spiritual quest. Mine was more to, you know, I had a deep interest going way back to all aspects of the paranormal. And it really started with me to find out how much of this was true and what it meant for our understanding of ourselves, our understanding of reality and the universe that we live in. So I wasn't coming in quite so much from what you might call a religious path or a spiritual path. Although, of course, the work that I've done since meeting Lynn, or the research that we've done, has very much taken me in that direction. But ultimately, it's everything for me is about trying to work out what this cosmos we live in is and our place in it. That's what it comes down to for me.
It's fascinating that when Lynn was talking about her path and she said that she was researching the paranormal and then she found you. Was that a paranormal occurrence?
You can't get much more paranormal than five.
It was certainly a synchronicity.
Yep.
Because as I always say, we actually met, we'd both gone to a lecture, which actually being held in somebody's flat apartment in London, and yeah, we'd seen it advertised, and we both decided to go along, and we actually both arrived on this guy's doorstep, or the doorstep to the building, from opposite directions at the same time, and then we rang the bell for the guy to come down, because it was a couple of floors up. It took him a while to get down. So even though we're British, we actually got talking to each other. and we've often looked back on that and thought, if either one of us had been a minute or two earlier or later and we hadn't actually hit that doorstep at the same time, none of this would have happened.
Yeah.
And to put it another way, if we hadn't have both arrived at that doorstep at that same moment, Dan Brown wouldn't be a multimillionaire.
That's absolutely true. You know, you talk about synchronicity, and that's something that's been preeminent in my life. Have you had other examples of that in your lives?
Yes, many. In my own experience, I've not really had that many kind of what you might call paranormal experiences, although some. But the main ones for me have been meaningful coincidences, shall we say.
Yeah. I mean, meeting the right people at the right moment, being introduced to somebody at a party we weren't even going to go to, that kind of thing. And then everything worked out from there. I mean, I'm sure most people, when they think about it, have something like that in their lives. Sort of positive synchronicities that, there's the other sort as well, but, I think it's a mistake to dwell on those.
A lot of folks don't recognize them, and not to talk about myself, but I'll share one very quickly that I think you'll both be amused by. My wife was first married to a cab driver in her first marriage. Before she met me, she almost started dating another cab driver. My last name in German means cab driver, so I was the one she was looking for.
Oh, of course, yeah, of course. That's just brilliant.
There's another synchronicity. So let's talk a little bit about your earlier collaborations. Please tell us about the startling discovery you share in Turin Shroud and the genius behind it.
Well, we actually met when the Shroud of Turin had been tested in the late 1980s and shown absolutely conclusively not to be the actual winding sheet of Jesus mysteriously imprinted with his image, as millions of believers, Catholic believers, did hold to. But it was, a medieval or early Renaissance fake. And at that point, so many people, you can imagine, just sort of went off it. They thought, well, who cares? It's a fake, next object. Let's, leave it behind us. But that was when Clive and I really got interested, because we knew quite a bit about it anyway. And we knew that it wasn't your average fake. It wasn't a painting. It wasn't a brass rubbing. What was it? And we set ourselves the, you might say the foolish task of trying to find out, after all this time, who did it and how? And you might say that we were on an absolute hiding to nothing. There was no way we could come up with this. And I suppose it's another series of synchronicities that actually helped us on the way. But we did actually, we started by eliminating the obvious person. We thought, there is an obvious person. It's Leonardo da Vinci. Let's eliminate him from our inquiries and move on and see if we can find somebody else, because, he's so obvious. But that is where we stopped, because all the evidence is that Leonardo da Vinci faked the Turing Shroud. Not only did he fake it, but he faked it using a very primitive sort of photography, and also it's his own face on it. So basically, the Turing Shroud isn't just a photograph by Leonardo da Vinci, it's of Leonardo da Vinci.
So in essence, it was the first selfie.
Yes, absolutely.
And the brilliance that you talk about is the fact that he actually created, in essence, a pinhole camera.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, that wasn't the difficult part, because the camera obscura, as a curiosity, had actually been known for centuries before Leonardo, which projected images. But what nobody had come up with was a method of actually retaining the image, of actually capturing it on the equivalent of film. But essentially, we showed that it's possible to do that using the materials and technology that were available in Leonardo's day. And then we just put through a whole lot of evidence together, which had actually got even more exciting in recent years.
And that ultimate revelation was?
The main thing was that similarity between the Turing Shroud and a painting of Leonardo's that was only recently discovered back in, I think, 2012, called the Salvator Mundi, and how the two images correspond so precisely, it can't be coincidence.
And a little bit of ego in him painting himself as savior of the world.
Yeah. That was his style. He liked to include himself in his paintings when he could.
My guests are Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. We're talking about their new book, When God Had a Wife, The Fall and Rise of the Sacred Feminine in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. We'll be back with more after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going Om? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guests this week, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, we're talking about When God Had a Wife, The Fall and Rise of the Sacred Feminine in the Judeo-Christian Tradition, and a lot more about the work that they've done. So the Turing Shroud led to your next work and the one that inspired Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. What inspired the Templar revelation?
Well, actually, it was a continuation or direct follow-on from our book about Leonardo and the Turing Shroud, because during the process of that research, we'd got interested in Leonardo da Vinci and his beliefs and what motivated him, including to do things like the Shroud. And essentially, we discovered in his paintings a code. The first chapter of Temple of Revelation is actually entitled The Secret Code of Leonardo da Vinci. It's kind of familiar now. this came out in 1997, by the way. And essentially, the code we found in there, or the symbolism, was all connected with John the Baptist. And seemed to indicate that Leonardo da Vinci considered John the Baptist as being more important and superior to Jesus himself. And having sort of gone through all that symbolism in his paintings and convinced ourselves that that was correct. I mean, there's other heretical ideas in there as well, including to do with Mary Magdalene. But the one that was completely new to us was the John the Baptist thing, which led us to then start to ask ourselves, okay, was that just some quirk of Leonardo's, or had people since his time and indeed before his time shared that belief in that the John the Baptist was the more important one than Jesus?
And that's when the whole can of worms opened, the whole Johannite heresy, which we were not familiar with at all. As Clive said, we uncovered it through Leonardo, and basically you know, there was this astonishing secret heresy that bubbled along under the surface over the years through the likes of the Knights Templar and others, and you know, really hard-hitting, believed that Jesus was a false prophet and John the Baptist was the true Christ, and Leonardo was absolutely not the only Johannite around, and this was amazing. So, you know, we were really caught up with that. That was one of the big takeaways from writing that book.
Tell us more about the Johannites. Who were the Johannites?
Essentially, they are. It's a heresy, a heretical tradition that regards John the Baptist, not Jesus, as the true Christ. And actually, you know, they believe not just that John was the more important one, but that Jesus actually usurped the position that ought to have been rightfully John's. And the interesting thing, when you trace that right back to the beginning, right back to the time of Jesus and John the Baptist, we find actually there's an enormous amount of evidence, because obviously there are various heretical beliefs that have sprung up over the years that aren't actually based on anything real. But when we trace the history back, we found actually there's quite a lot to support this, the idea that actually Jesus and John the Baptist, although they started on the same team, actually ended up rivals, and that there was indeed a rival sect or religion early Christianity that actually upheld John, not Jesus, as the one. It was certainly around. It's recorded in early writings. It's recorded in Arab writings through to the 8th century. So it was around a long time, and indeed it still exists to this day in the form of a sect or a people called the Mandians, who live in the southern Iraq and Iran, although because of recent events in that part of the world, they've spread out into other places around the world.
And one thing that really hit us forcibly was, you know, they say history is written by the victors. Well, even the New Testament is written by the victors. Essentially, what the New Testament is propaganda on behalf of the Jesus Party, if you like. You know, John the Baptist being the great rival, he was practically written out. He couldn't have been written out completely because he was so famous in his day. They had to have him there. But instead, you know, they wrote him as this character who was prostrating himself before Jesus, when in fact that can't have happened. That simply can't have happened. And in fact, we're not the only people to say that. You know, theologians have been saying that for quite some time now. One of the other things, of course, that we take away from all of our books about these things is how theologians and academics know a lot of the stuff that we just piece together and put together. But in fact, it never filters down to the people who attend church.
And do you think this was a conspiracy of silence?
Yes, absolutely. Or a conspiracy of suppression, you know, because you find in the New Testament, you know, a few figures, but the key ones being John the Baptist and Mary Magdalene, who it's very clear just from reading them that the writers have said as little about these individuals as they possibly can. And you really get the impression that if they could have left them out of the story entirely, they would have done, because they would have told the audience, the readership, something that they didn't want them to know. In other words, they wanted a particular story about Jesus and who he was and what he was about. They were trying to promote that story. They were keeping anything out of the story that detracted from their message, and it involved, you know, certain individuals, John, Mary Magdalene. Then you really get the impression that if they could have left them out completely, they would, but they were too well known to actually do that. So basically they put them, they included them in the story for as little as possible, and you know, kind of change the story around a little to, you know, change the emphasis, for example, to make John the Baptist only important as this person that came to pave the way for Jesus, whereas it's actually apparent from, you know, other accounts of the time that he actually was a huge figure in his own right, and had a huge following in his own right, not just because he'd come to set up, you know, the one who is to come after, you know. And, you know, just to pick one example of even how this, you can reconstruct this from the Gospels themselves, is that there's a, you know, a famous, well, actually it's not that famous because it's not read out in churches that much, but there is this episode in the Gospels where John the Baptist has been arrested, he's in prison, and he gets a message through some of his disciples sent out to Jesus to say, are you really the one who is to come, or should we seek another? And just actually when we've come across that during the research for Temple Revelation, looking at John the Baptist, as soon as you come across that, you think, this changes the picture entirely, because why is he now, if he was kind of inspired by God to recognize Jesus, why has he suddenly changed his mind?
But no, the average Christians don't know that, because their attention is never brought to it.
Mm. And getting back to the Knights Templar, do you think the Friday the 13th massacre had to do with their knowledge of the Johannites, or their belief in the Johannites, or their participation in the Johannite belief, or because of the fact that they were controlling money?
I think a bit of both. I think the money thing was important. The French king who organized the raid, the dawn raids across France to arrest the Templars. I mean, you know, he wanted their money. He owed them money and he wasn't going to pay it back, let's be honest. Alongside that, he accused them of certain very big heretical practices. And he accused them of worshipping a bearded, severed head. He accused them of spitting and trampling on the cross. Now, our research has shown that, I mean, the average Templar would be a straightforward Christian. To him, Jesus Christ would be, you know, God, and no two ways about it, you know, absolutely. But the inner circle of the Knights Templar, the prime movers of the movement, almost certainly were Johannite, and instigated Johannite ceremonies. So therefore, they worshipped, or at least revered, a severed head. And the Bible tells us John the Baptist was beheaded. And they spit and trample on the cross in a ritual, which sounds utterly appalling. But from their perspective, it made perfect sense, because they were trampling on the symbol of John the Baptist's great rival, Jesus.
And of course, your book, The Templar Revelation, led to Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. What was your relationship like with Dan Brown?
Well, when he was writing the book, you know, we knew nothing about it. Just to explain what the, you know, we say it's the direct inspiration, which it was, but obviously for those that have read the Da Vinci Code, and obviously a lot of people have, will know that there's a lot of other stuff in there that he took from other books, primarily a book called The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, and that he doesn't talk about the Johannites heresy that we've just been discussing. But it was finding that book that gave him the idea. So finding our book that gave him the idea for basing something around Leonardo da Vinci and his codes. And it was through reading our book that he learnt about books like the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail and the other sources. So it kind of took all his research, really was based on reading the Tempter Revelation, even though he went off in other directions. But we didn't get to meet Dan Brown until a few years later, a couple of years later, when there was I don't know if you remember, there was a big court case in London where a couple of the authors of Holy Blood and the Holy Grail sued Dan Brown, or rather his publisher, for plagiarism. Mm-hmm. and lost their case spectacularly. And during that time, we went to the court and we met Dan Brown there. Nice guy. And of course, and the other thing that we always have to throw in is, as a result of this sort of kind of an acknowledgement, Lynn and I actually ended up being given cameo roles in the Da Vinci Code movie. So
yes, as the bus passengers.
Yes, famous bus passengers. That's a, yep.
My guests this week, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, the authors of the new book, When God Had a Wife, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Sacred Feminine in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. Please tell our listeners where they can get that book and find out more about you and your work.
They can get the book from bookshops, presumably, certainly from Amazon. And they can find out more about us from our website, www.picknettprince.com.
And you can order books through there. So
yes. Oh, please do.
Please do. We'll be back with more of Lynn and Clive after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Tune in to The Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World, with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guests this week, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, authors of the new book, When God Had a Wife, The Fall and Rise of the Sacred Feminine in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. I've always been fascinated by the magic and mystery of ancient Egypt, and in your book, The Stargate Conspiracy, you present a startling thesis about how Western interest in Egypt was actually manipulated to control us. Please explain.
Yes, this Stargate Conspiracy, which actually came out, actually is 20 years old this year, and still around, still in print, still selling, which in a way is remarkable, because the reason we wrote it was because we were heading towards the millennium at that point. The strange thing was, it grew out of Templar Revelation, But took us off in a surprising direction into what turned out to be kind of our most X-Files type book, because at the end of Temple Revelation, we'd concluded that there was a heavy influence of the Egyptian religion on the whole Jesus and John the Baptist thing. And we naturally started to research the ancient Egyptian religion, thinking to write more about that. But at that time, this is the late 1990s, if people remember that time, there was a whole series of books coming out about new discoveries to do with ancient Egypt and the pyramids and the Sphinx. And they were all sort of building this expectation, not just that the past is very different to what the history books say, and that many of the monuments of Egypt and the ancient Egyptian civilization are much older than the history books say, but they're actually building up to this idea that that had a meaning for us today, that it had a secret for us, and that it was something that was going to happen around the time of the millennium, that some discovery was going to be made in Egypt that was going to change everything. And as we started to look, we were quite excited by these
books. Very excited,
But as we actually started to look into them, we said, actually, there's something not quite right about this, because a lot of that information that was coming out, and then it was starting to connect up with other things, like the, I don't know if people remember the Face on Mars controversy that was all around at the same time, various other things. And they were all sort of being the answers to these mysteries. The mysteries are genuine in many cases, but the answers seem to be being contrived and manipulated in order to fit a particular system of belief. And then we realized that that's the whole point, that it was all building up to try and support and validate this system of belief, ready for something to happen around the time of the millennium. And it's quite a big and complicated story to summarize in just a minute or so. But essentially it came down to there was a channeling cult based a thing called the Council of Nine that had actually been going for 40 odd years at that point, longer, nearly 50 years, which was a cult that claimed to channel extraterrestrial intelligences that had been the gods of ancient Egypt, that had been worshipped as the gods of ancient Egypt. But this group was actually a very, very select group, which comprised some people really from the American elite, very, very wealthy business people, people in politics, even a former vice president of the United States. And the whole thing seemed to be about getting this sort of message to them that they were chosen people in contact with these extraterrestrial space gods.
But of course, the absolute clincher, when you think about it, is to build up the excitement. You know, the ancient gods are back, and you are the chosen ones because you're in this group, which is an elite group, and you are hearing the words of the ancient gods themselves. And of course, if they really believe that, then these beings, these entities, or whatever they happen to be really, could tell them to do anything, and they'd believe it, and they'd probably do it. So it was actually a very long-term experiment in belief, in how to manipulate belief. Very cold-blooded, very cynical, and, we managed to locate the power behind the throne, who was actually a fascinating man, not cuddly, not a nice bloke, but a chap called Andrei Puharik, who was a US Army doctor and an inventor, who basically used drugs, he used hypnosis, and he just implanted ideas in people's heads for various experiments. And he was involved in the Council of Nine early days too. So, it's not much of a 2 and 2 make 5. Basically, he was behind it, and it was not a nice path to be on.
And he was someone that's very heavily connected with the Pentagon, and he worked for the CIA. So there seemed to be this whole, as Lynn said, an experiment in manipulating belief, and like most belief, in ultimately it becomes about control. But what worried us is that that whole thing had been put out to a wider audience, not just to this elite group, but was getting to quite a mass audience. And the whole thing was kind of becoming a bit of a roller coaster, building up to the millennium, that something was going to happen that was apparently going to validate that entire belief system. So we thought we'd put all this together in a book and get it out there.
Yeah.
Basically, to warn people.
Yes. I mean, a lot of the stuff that the Council of Nine channelers were coming out with was really quite horrible, actually. It was racist. There was an awful lot of racist stuff. But, of course, it was the gods, you know, coming out with it, so you couldn't criticise it. So that was one of the major, almost also ran problems with it, but it was a major problem, was the inherent racism, which was being pushed at people, that this elite group and the others, the hangers on.
So in essence, a lot of this work that you've done from really the beginning of your first work together up until that point had been about people trying to subjugate and control the masses.
Yeah,
it is, and you know, we could actually, while we were working on the Stargate conspiracy, which really got across to us the power of belief. Actually, belief is a weapon. You know, it's not... I think people... You know, there's often the phrase that's around coming out from George Orwell's 1984 of the thought police, people trying to control the way we think. But actually much more dangerous would be belief police, because belief is much more powerful than thinking, than thought. You know, if you can get people to believe, you know, believe in a particular system, you can get them to do anything. And straight off, there was a, as we worked on Stargate Conspiracy, and it brought us home that the power of that kind of belief, if you could convince a lot of people that you were in touch with, and giving the words, you know, becoming prophets to, you know, extraterrestrial space gods that had been worshipped in ancient Egypt, what a powerful thing that could be. And we actually began to realize the parallels with what had happened a couple of thousand years earlier with the church putting a message on what Jesus had done. And, you know, and it's almost like kind of a rerun of that. It's belief is an incredibly powerful thing. And as you say, it's something that has run through all our work. It didn't set out that way, but it just was something that kept coming up.
And more currently, and more of our generation's knowledge, the power that Hitler had over the people of Germany and what he used it for.
Absolutely. You know, it's a simple thing. It was an emotional...
Yeah, an emotional charge.
Yeah. It wasn't a reasoned argument that, you know, you can follow this reasoning and come to this conclusion. It was like religions, you know. I mean, the ultimate message for control has ever been is, if you don't belong to this church and do what we do, you're going to spend eternity in hell.
Absolutely.
That is, from a control point of view, yes, the best advertising line ever. You know, look where it's led.
Yeah. Now, your just published book, When God Had a Wife, answers some of the questions that I had as a child growing up in the 1950s and 60s. How did this book come about?
Well, as you know, we've written extensively, actually, about the sacred feminine in other books, the Templar Revelation. And actually, I wrote a book by myself called Mary Magdalene, Christianity's Hidden Goddess. But we still had questions. We still had to put certain things together to our satisfaction. And also, one of the other things, you know, Jesus and Mary Magdalene and all his entourage, if you like, all his group, didn't suddenly appear out of nowhere with no background. You know, we wanted to go back to the early Israelite. My throat's going. And we wanted to go back to the early Israelites and see what their religion was, what it really was, and how it could have affected Jesus and Mary all those years later.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Continue.
Yeah, well, it was trying to get into the backstory of what Jesus, Mary Magdalene, John the Baptist were about. As Lynn said, we'd realised that there was the sacred feminine was a big part of their mission, their agenda, what motivated them. So we were looking back into at a certain point when we were writing Tempter Revelation, we were thinking they seem to have adopted a lot of this from Egypt, sort of made a kind of hybrid religion of Egyptian sort of goddess worship and Judaism. But we wanted to look back further and see if that was correct. And actually the conclusions we've come to in When God Had a Wife show that our original conclusions were partly incorrect, but have widened the whole thing out to make a much bigger picture that makes a lot more sense of the role of the sacred feminine in the Israelite religion, in the Hebrew religion, and how that had influenced what Jesus and Mary Magdalene were trying to do.
My guests are Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. Their book is When God Had a Wife, The Fall and Rise of the Sacred Feminine in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. We'll be back with more after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the Om Times Experts program. With Om Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone?
Do flowers have best friends?
I don't know.
Hey, look.
Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Why should you volunteer with Meals on Wheels?
I'll come to the door with one meal and I'll walk away with a full heart.
Drop off a warm meal and get more than you expect. Volunteer at americaletsdolunch.org. Brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guests this week, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, authors of When God Had a Wife, The Fall and Rise of the Sacred Feminine in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. Why do you think that both Judaism and Christianity have effectively airbrushed the sacred feminine out of their religions?
Well, we were talking about this quite a lot, as you can imagine, recently, because it's not clear-cut, as people think. It's not just these nasty men did it because they hated women. There's an element to that. And personally, I think it's quite interesting that the sacred feminine was really erased, or almost entirely erased, from both Christianity and before that from Judaism, when the respective religions were being codified. So basically, it was when the rules were put in place, and inflexible rules. This is what you had to believe from both Judaism and later Christianity. And it was at that point that there was no room for the sacred feminine. It was all a masculine god. You know, it was she simply wasn't there. And there was no room for the sacred feminine among the priesthood as well.
What effect has this had on the treatment of their female worshippers over the centuries, as well as the lives of women in society?
As far as the worshippers are concerned, obviously it limits their participation in the religion. They can't, traditionally in the past, they couldn't become priests. They couldn't have any position of authority. They could just be worshippers. So it very much limited, you know, both within Judaism and Christianity, the ability of women to participate and to contribute. And that, of course, you know, given the the way that religion permeated all aspects of those cultures, again, until quite recently, that has a huge effect on the lives of women in practical ways. But beyond that, it also has a great spiritual constraint on them. It does actually too on the lives of men, but they probably didn't realise it or feel it quite so much.
Well, it will do, because of course it's the effect on the lives of women and their children. So, you know, so they have male children. So basically it's doing nobody any favours.
Because by removing the feminine from the religion, from the spirituality, it creates the idea that women are less important than men. And, you know, therefore it degrades women, both their own sense of self-worth and, you know, the way that they're viewed by society generally. They're told, you know, that they are beneath men. They're the bottom of the pile socially. So I mean, it's had a huge, very damaging effect on
the psyche.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Many liberal synagogues are now presided over by female rabbis, and there are a growing number of women priests in churches. Is that enough, or would you like to see something else happen as a result of your book?
The first point to make is that, you know, we're not a member of any church or any synagogue or anything. So it's, to some extent, we are removed from that question in an immediate sense. My personal bugbear is, you look at television and see pictures of the Pope and all the cardinals sitting there, and you think, where are the women? It's the 21st century. Come on, boys. Admit you don't have all the answers. Admit that you've been lying about the sacred feminine for all these years. Do something about it, because it's imploding. I just obviously feel incredibly strongly about that. But I just think that as long as you have this real antipathy towards the sacred feminine, certainly in the Catholic Church, you are going to get these terrible things happening on a huge scale, you know, the sexual abuse by priests, which, okay, it also happens in other religions, but not nearly to the same extent. And that is a fact. And it's the deep hurt on the psyche of the priests that they don't have a holy mother to turn to. They don't, instead of, you know, the Papa, the Pope, there is no equivalent of the Pope as a woman. So, and there should be. There really, really should be. And more importantly, our reading of what Jesus was about, Jesus would have wanted there to be a female Pope as well. You know, he was about balance. I think it's outrageous that, you know, there's the Pope and all his male cardinals. And I think it's going to be a very, very tough ride for them. But eventually, I think they're going to be brought down, because people will not have it.
How did the sacred feminine manifest in Jesus' own movement?
In two ways, really, through Jesus' own teaching and his, part of his mission, where Jesus, reading below the lines of the Gospels and the teachings attributed to him in there, but not very far from there. Once the correct translation and the correct meaning of certain words are understood, is that Jesus presented himself as the messenger of wisdom, of Sophia, which was, it wasn't just wisdom in its most kind of nebulous sense or its general sense. Sophia was basically a rewriting of the goddess that had been suppressed from the Judaic religion. Wisdom was a goddess figure. And Jesus, in the Gospels, particularly in things like the Sermon on the Mount, actually presents himself as the messenger, to the point that, and this is something that's actually understood by scholars and academics and specialists in this, to the point that there were some scholars who actually call Jesus, Jesus Sophia. He was so much a central part of his message. The other way it manifested is through the participation of women in his movement, which is something that has been almost completely erased from the Gospels. But the fact he had female disciples, and in particular Mary Magdalene, who played a key role in his movement, actually as effectively as a priestess for Sophia. So when Jesus is presenting himself as the messenger of Sophia, of the goddess, in some ways, it actually presented himself as the messenger of Mary Magdalene.
Were they married?
No, not to each other. I know it's almost a tenet, you know, now, after Da Vinci Code and so on, that people say, well, of course they were married. The fact is that Jesus must have been married by the time he was 20 years old, because every single boy in his culture had to be, no exceptions. And often it was around the age of 15 or 16 they got married. So Jesus will have been married to somebody, but it was almost certainly not Mary Magdalene. Because the thing is, you know, the Bible doesn't have any problem in talking about, you know, the wives of prophets or whatever. And if she had been his wife, it would have said Mary, wife of the Saviour. Even if they didn't like her, they would have to call her that. But there's no such mention. So basically, they were in a relationship that was priest-priestess, but also, according to the forbidden Gospels, the ones that are not in the New Testament, very largely known as the Gnostic Gospels that were discovered in 1945, basically it's very obvious from those, and they all tell a very consistent story, that Mary and Jesus were in an intimate relationship, which very, very much annoyed the men in the group, particularly Simon Peter, who hated her. Mm. So it wasn't all sweetness and light. And, you know, I often say in talks and things that she was, reading between the lines, her effect on the group was pretty much like Yoko Ono turning up with the Beatles. Mm. She was quite abrasive, I think. That's not to say, you know, we shouldn't admire her in many respects, but I think she was quite abrasive, and she did not understand how to behave in front of the men of that place and time. Maybe she did understand, and she just didn't want to. You know, she didn't want to do it right.
What can a renewed awareness of the sacred feminine mean to Jews and Christians today?
I think it will. It should get them to have a wider understanding of their religion and what it was supposed to have been from the start, or what it originally was. It's not a matter so much of, as our culture has become more and more respectful of women, and more, giving women, a measure of equality. Still a long way to go, obviously, and a lot more respect. Because our culture has got to that point that we're now trying to kind of work it into the religion, that the historical facts show that actually that's what it was like at the beginning. Mm. And that it was something that was removed. It's why the subtitle of our book is not, as you would expect, the rise and fall of the sacred feminine. It's actually the fall and rise of the sacred feminine.
She won't go away.
Yeah, but she was there at the beginning. Mm. She was taken out. Now she's being put back in to the place that always should have been hers. So a renewed awareness and understanding of that's the way things were to begin with should, you know, make a big difference to Jews and Christians.
And to question everything.
Absolutely. You know, to me, your partnership and collaboration is a reflection of the co-creative relationship that our world so sorely needs to get back to. Do you see it as such?
Now you say it, yes. I mean, it's not like it wasn't a deliberate thing that we set out to do. It just kind of grew organically. But now you think about it, you know, the two of us have our own very different ways of looking at things. You know, I tend to do the research, Lynn tends to do the writing. It's not as 50-50 as that. We both do a bit of each. And the crucial thing is the bit in the middle, where we actually look at the information and decide what it means and how it should be presented. So we do have those different ways of looking at that complement each other. You know, and I think that's, you know, we couldn't be doing this individually. What would come out would be very different, I think.
No, I mean, I think there is an almost perfect balance in temperament and in roles that we've assigned ourselves over the years. So, yeah, it works. You know, hallelujah, it works.
My guests, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, the authors of the new book, When God Had a Wife, The Fall and Rise of the Sacred Feminine in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. One more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Well, there's a website, which is www.picknettprints.com. So you can find out all about us and all of our books on there. Plus, you can, you know, there are links there through there to Amazon, so you can actually buy the books, order the books. But they're available from, you know, all the normal outlets. So
thank you both so much for joining us and sharing your story and this very important work that you do.
Thank you for having us here.
Thank you for inviting us. It has been a pleasure. Yeah. So thank you, Victor.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.